Hi, it's Amy Siskin of The Weekly List and author of the book The List. And welcome to episode 148 of The Weekly List podcast. This is the 14th segment in a section called Democracy at Risk. Welcome. The reason for this podcast is yet another historic and unprecedented event has taken place. Last week, the FBI executed a search warrant at a former president's home, and that being Donald J. Trump's primary residence of Mar-a-Lago. Trump was not there at the time. He was up in New York being deposed by New York Attorney General Letitia James. He did, however, post about it, not on Twitter or Facebook, where he's still banned, both platforms, but on Truth Social, which he is in part an owner of. We're going to be speaking about the litigation that Trump is facing currently as we close out this podcast. But I wanted to start this week on the state of things as we head into midterms. We are now 80 days away. About a year ago, I wrote a piece that you can find on the Weekly List website, theweeklylist.org, called "I Sounded the Alarm for Authoritarianism in 2016, and I Am Sounding It Again." A year ago, my fear was that Trump was trying to install loyalists into key positions in six key states ahead of the 2024 election. Those states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Arizona, and Georgia, were all considered to be bellwether states in the 2020 election. And all of them had elections coming up in 2022 to decide the balance of power for governor, attorney general, and secretary of state. Fast forward almost a year later, here we sit, and most of the primaries are over, and for those six states, they are over. 94% so far of Trump's endorsed candidates have won GOP races in 222 primaries. It's not really that high because sometimes he comes in late and endorses a clear winner, but it's high enough. He still has his stranglehold on the Republican Party. Of the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach him after the January 6th insurrection, four of the 10 have retired, two won their primaries, and four lost their primaries, including most recently, last week, Liz Cheney, who was formerly the third ranking Republican in the House of Representatives. She lost her primary in a landslide to a Trump-backed election denier. It's not all peaches and cream, however, Trump's success in endorsing candidates that turned out to be the GOP candidates in 2022. There are, again, those six states Trump has had great luck in installing loyalists to run. Out of the 87 candidates that are running in those six states for either their House seats, Senate, Attorney General, Secretary of State, or Governor, 54 of 87 are election deniers. 54 of 87. Crazy land. These 54 believe the 2020 election was not decided fairly. Some have gone so far as to say, including the candidates now that the Republicans have picked to run for governor and secretary of state, that they would not have certified the 2020 result that Biden had won. They would have overturned that result. Now, the reason I say it's not all peaches and cream is some of these people are Looney Tunes. And if you look at, for example, the Senate and who will keep the balance of power, right now it's 50-50 with our vice president being the deciding vote. So technically, the Democrats are the majority. If we were to have this conversation on 3 months ago on June 1st, the odds of Democrats keeping the Senate would have been about 40%. There was a 60% chance that Republicans were going to win the Senate, back control of the Senate. And that's in part because we're heading into midterms in 80 days. And typically the party out of power is the party that picks up seats. However, because of these loyalists that Trump has put himself behind and who have won their primaries, that has totally shifted. And now Democrats, according to 538, which tracks such things, tracks polls of polls, now they give Democrats a 63% chance of winning. So Democrats have gone from 40% to 63% in a period of less than 3 months. The candidates for Senate in Arizona, in Michigan, where you have Herschel Walker, a former football player, in Pennsylvania, Dr. Mehmet Oz, who has run a horrendous campaign, Nevada, as well as other states like Ohio, North Carolina, all of these states are suddenly in play, and it looks great for Democrats. And in part, some of these are just Trump loyalists who are crazy land. Similarly, races for governor in states like Michigan, in states like Pennsylvania. Again, Trump extremists have won, and they will be running, and their chances of winning those seats are very low. So that's why I say it's not peaches and cream. And I'm a lot more sanguine than I was a year ago about Trump's prospects for setting up for a 2024 coup, because it looks pretty clear from the polling that most of these people are going to lose. In fact, Pennsylvania, which is one I was very worried about, in that state, kind of uniquely, whoever wins the governor actually picks the Secretary of State, but the guy Mastriano picked by Trump is like crazy land. And Josh Shapiro looks like he'll just stroll right in. Same with Fetterman in Pennsylvania. So without getting too far into the weeds, this idea of Trump having a stranglehold has not served the GOP well. But it does raise, again, a question about the state of play of the Republican Party and the fact that we haven't returned to normal. The fact that we have so many election deniers who are willing to put our democracy at risk to be a cult of one, to do whatever Trump says and be, carrying out his bidding. So again, and the whole reason that we shifted this podcast from returning back to normal to democracy at risk is that one of our two parties is still very dysfunctional and is still, a cult of leadership, and with one person having a lot of influence and saying daily he's going to be running for president in 2024. But again, the good news where we sit today, the loyalists he's looking to install to essentially overturn the results of these six key states, most of them look as if they will not be in a position to win. The other major thing that we discussed in the last podcast was the Supreme Court. Three of the nine seats were appointed by Trump. The Supreme Court overruling Roe and the impact that will have not only in our country, but the first shocks we're going to have on that are the midterms. The first referendum on Roe was put to test in Kansas, and that's a state that Trump won by 15 points when he ran last. It's a red state. It's not the reddest state, but it's a safely red state for a president. They had an election where basically voters were asked to vote on a constitutional amendment that would have said there was no right to abortion in the state. By a vote of 59 to 41, they voted no to that in Kansas. So basically what that's saying is a 33-point shift from being plus 15 for Trump to being negative 18 on wanting to get rid of the abortion rights that state had. 33-point shift, which was big news, because that really has wide implications for how much people are going to care, including independent voters, about this major loss of freedom for women. And that's the way it was framed there, and the way it's being framed in several states as those primaries and turn into general election races. States that I mentioned, like Ohio and North Carolina, which previously probably would have been pretty safely red seats. Those are both elections for vacated red seats. Now have Democrats in the lead. Tim Ryan in Ohio and Sherry Beasley in North Carolina. And Sherry, I will be hosting in September at my home, also on Zoom. You can find the invitation for that on my social media. But she looks in a position to actually turn that seat blue. So you can see how these major implications of two major things, of Trump picking extremist candidates who are election deniers, and also of the Republican Party, and this is an aspect of authoritarianism, you know, targeting women and taking away rights. Both of those things colliding will have made what should have been like a cakewalk for Republicans heading into these midterms into the Senate favoring Democrats and the House. Right now, the Democrats have a 1 in 5 chance of keeping the House, but I'm going to be hedging my bet there and saying I think we have a chance to keep the House. To be determined. So now I want to get into the reason for recording this podcast, and that is the litigation that Trump is facing, and specifically the most newsworthy was the FBI executing the search warrant at Mar-a-Lago. But it's hardly that alone. It's sort of like all these embers that have been slowly burning are suddenly heating up all at once. We've covered the January 6th Select Committee in prior podcasts. They have, you know, happily, for those of us who would like to see some justice and broken norms fixed, they've done an exemplary job in educating the public on what happened. One of the roles of this committee is to come up with measures after their work is done so we can avoid this ever happening again. And they have done an amazing amount of work towards that. They've also been especially effective in using Republican voices, many of whom were part of the Trump regime, to tell the stories of what happened that day and leading up to that day and in the days that followed. Interestingly, while all these hearings have been going on, the Justice Department has also been watching the hearings and conducting a concurrent criminal probe of Trump's team's role in the January 6th insurrection and their efforts to overturn the election results. This week, the New York Times reported that a grand jury convened by the Department of Justice, a case brought by the Department of Justice, issued a subpoena to the National Archives in May. So we're learning about it now, but the subpoena was issued in May for records related to January 6th, including files of Mr. Trump's top aides, his daily schedule and phone logs, a draft text of his speech that he gave that preceded the riot. Trump's tried unsuccessfully to exert executive privilege over many of the documents, but that did not work in the end. The grand jury subpoenas were also issued to far-right figures like Ali Alexander, who organized the Stop the Steal events, as well as to state lawmakers and state Republican officials who had taken part in what was, we've come to know, was this a fake elector scheme. And they've also issued subpoenas to ascertain the role that people like Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman played in devising and carrying out the plan to overturn the election. So a lot more is coming out about January 6th. Some of it, again, with the House and their hearings that they are holding publicly. But then some of it, we're just getting these little leaks that show up in the media of Trump aides, of Trump former attorneys, et cetera, being subpoenaed by the grand jury convened on criminal charges surrounding January 6th. So both of those are things Trump is facing. Separately, as I mentioned in the lead into this, where was Trump the day that the search warrant was being executed at Mar-a-Lago? He was in New York, and he was being deposed by New York Attorney General Letitia James, who questioned him in a civil probe of whether the Trump Organization fraudulently inflated the value of his assets to secure loans and other benefits. In his deposition, again, the king of hypocrisy, Trump pleaded the fifth 440 times, reportedly. If you've been following Trump and his speeches over a period of years, he is well known to be on the record in previous statements, deriding people who take the Fifth Amendment as something only guilty people do, once saying that the mob only takes the Fifth. So that was happening in New York. At the same time, also in the news last week, Manhattan DA's criminal investigation of longtime Trump Organization accountant Alan Weisselberg. He pleaded guilty this last week to 15 felonies. He will serve 5 months in Rikers Island. It's amazing this guy didn't turn on Trump. This guy's in his 70s, he's going to Rikers. He admitted that he conspired with the Trump Organization to carry out a scheme to avoid paying taxes on lavish perks. So in addition to serving his time in Rikers, his plea deal, he will testify as part of the Manhattan DA's case against the Trump Org, but he will not be required to cooperate in a broader criminal investigation of Donald J. Trump. So again, yet another person taking it, you know, on the backside for Trump while Trump skates away potentially. But again, Alan Weisselberg, his long-term accountant, pleading guilty and to serve time in Rikers. Also, there's more. A three-panel judge, D.C. Federal Appeals Court judges ruled that the House Ways and Means Committee is entitled to review Trump's tax returns from 2015 to 2020. You'll remember from the weekly list that committee's chair, Richard Neal, had first requested Trump's tax returns in 2019. He's been waiting ever since. Here we are, 3 years later. Finally, the three-judge panel ruled unanimously that Trump needed to turn those over. Trump, this last week, has also requested for the full bench of the D.C. Federal Courts of Appeal to review his ruling. But there's more. Georgia. Now, this is also a very interesting case and could be really the one that comes forward to be the most impactful, although that's hard with this group to know. But all of these are just like major happenings. Everything's kind of brewing at the same time. In Georgia, the Atlanta District Attorney Fannie Willis has been conducting a criminal investigation that she opened in February of 2021 into election interference in that state's election, 2020 election. She opened it after it was revealed that Trump had asked, remember, he asked Georgia's Secretary of State, Raffensperger, to find enough votes to overturn the state's results. I just need 11,800, whatever it was, number of votes in a phone call. A special grand jury that was convened by Willis has subpoenaed several of Trump allies. Last week, we learned that Rudy Giuliani was informed that he is also a target of the criminal investigation. Experts say that Willis is building a case that could target many defendants with charges of conspiracy to commit election fraud and racketeering. Prosecutors have warned some state officials and pro-Trump alternate electors. Remember, we just talked about those with the DOJ case as well, that they could be indicted. So these people that were going to be fake electors are going to face their consequences, so to speak, either from Georgia or from the DOJ case. Also, we learned that Trump ally Senator Lindsey Graham has been called on to testify. He's been fighting that, and that continues in court. But several Trump confidants, including Janet Ellis, have been subpoenaed to testify that Georgia criminal investigation seems to be chugging along, because we seem to get news on that now of a lot of folks that are being called in to testify, subpoenaed to testify. That also could be real trouble for Trump and his allies. And then finally, I want to conclude where we started and the reason for this podcast, which again, the FBI searched Mar-a-Lago after a search warrant was issued for documents that needed to be returned to the National Archive. This all started because Trump walked out after the whole melee around January 6th and in the final days of his time in office with boxes full of documents that didn't rightfully belong to him. They started off by issuing a subpoena and trying to get Trump to cooperate federal agents had been visiting with his, you know, consulting with his lawyers to take back what the National Archive had requested and was not getting. So they started off by playing nice and collecting the information. And eventually, according to reporting by the New York Times, there was something that Trump's lawyers signed in June saying that all the information that the National Archive had requested and was due to them had been returned. Well, guess what? That turned out not to be the case. So we initially learned that about the search of Mar-a-Lago from Trump posting on Truth Social, but then we've come to learn in subsequent days so much more about it. But just the initial reaction and how this all came down, you know, I've talked about in several of the podcasts and during the time of Trump's being in office about the divide in country and about Republicans and Fox News personalities stoking this idea of civil war. Well, after Trump released the fact, and that's how we learned about it, about the FBI searching his premises, that started a brigade of Republicans, including House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, insulting the FBI, calling for an investigation of the FBI, some more extremists calling for defunding the FBI. Within days, there was several incidents reported. One in Cincinnati where a Trump supporter who had also been part of the January 6th insurrection, had ties to far-right extremist group, the Proud Boys, tried to storm the Cincinnati FBI office. He was then, after a chase, shot and killed, but his social media revealed his upset with the FBI's actions. There was another plot foiled in Pennsylvania of a man similarly who had been incited by Republican lawmakers and Trump to attack the FBI. And then there was an incident where somebody drove into Washington, D.C., into a concrete wall and ended up shooting himself, but also with the objective of being so upset by the fact that Trump and Mar-a-Lago being searched. So all these things happen. And then within days, you could see the Republicans trying to tamp it back a little bit because, you know, the chatter was, and it was well reported, that the DHS and the FBI were alarmed by the threats and the FBI agents being doxxed and being personally threatened. Within 2 days, 3 days actually, Merrick Garland, our attorney general, made an unexpected public speech to the media, first of all, defending the FBI and the DOJ and saying, despite what Trump said, he did know about and was aware that they were signing off on the search warrant. But also basically calling Trump's bluff and saying that, you know, as Trump wanted everything disclosed, supposedly, that the DOJ would be filing in court to make public the search warrant. So that happened Friday afternoon in the summer. The court did release the search warrant. We learned that the FBI in between this time had seized 11 sets of documents in all, including numerous files that were marked as top secret from Mar-a-Lago, including some even viewed as classified TSSCI, which is shorthand for top secret, sensitive, compartmentalized information, which are only meant to be, when they say SCI, it's only meant to be viewed in a secure government facility where you can't bring in phones. It's super top secret. Trump had these lying around Mar-a-Lago, which is a club open to the public where members can kind of just walk through. He had this stuff lying around. In the meantime, we learned, according to Washington Post reporting, that some of these classified information that Trump was keeping at Mar-a-Lago may have included secrets related to nuclear weapons. So that raised all sorts of alarms. We also learned through this search warrant that there were the Department of Justice, and again, what started out with the National Archives just requesting this information back, We learned that there are now, the Department of Justice is moving forward with three different criminal investigations against Trump. The first, and this is shocking to say, and another unprecedented historical event, Trump is under investigation for violating the Espionage Act. We don't know exactly what that means, but we will learn. The second is obstruction of justice, and the third is removal or destruction of classified documents. Convictions for any of these three could result in jail time or fines. Now, Trump, as he often does, set out with a tour of lies, lie after lie, to try to cover his tracks here. First, he started by claiming that he had declassified all these documents, which there's no record of him doing so. And then, according to lawyers, it's not even relevant as relates to the Espionage Act. Whether the documents are unclassified or classified, they were not allowed to be at Trump's Mar-a-Lago. Also, he continued on, when that didn't seem to stick, that Biden was behind the raid, which also was not true. The White House issued a statement that Biden was not aware. He then said that the FBI tried on several occasions to say the FBI had planted the documents. And then he started to, you know, as he always does, blame Obama, saying Obama had done the same thing, to which the National Archive immediately released a statement saying that that was not true. So, subsequently, the media has pushed to have the full affidavit released for in the public interest, to let us know what Trump has, what these criminal charges are, and, you know, what is more information behind this unprecedented historical act. As of Friday, the same judge who had agreed to the search warrant agreed that despite the Department of Justice protesting wanting to make this public, to at least release parts of it and on a redacted basis. The Department of Justice has said it will hurt their ongoing criminal investigation. And we are led to believe that there's at least one person in Trump's inner circle that has been cooperating and giving information to the FBI, to the DOJ, that led to them knowing that not all the information had been returned. They're worried that that will also quash potentially people cooperating. They're also concerned about putting FBI agents' lives at risk if more names are given publicly in the affidavit. These people are being doxxed by Trump supporters, and the chatter is again calling for violence. So that's where we stand now. So we basically have seven major pieces of either litigation, civil, criminal litigation, including the January 6th Select Committee and whatever they come up with, all facing Trump all at once. And also having a huge impact as we head into these midterms, which now seemingly look more favorable to Democrats. But you can see a lot is on the line where we sit here 80 days out on midterms and waiting on more information on whether Trump could be charged criminally with any of these matters, with either the Espionage Act. You know, what was he doing with these nuclear documents, if the Washington Post reporting is correct? Obstruction, removal, then the Georgia criminal investigation and the DOJ criminal investigation of January 6th. So again, a lot happening at once. I want to close out with two other things. First of all, you know, we talk about authoritarianism in this project, and currently there's a lot of news out about books being banned in states, which is another side of authoritarianism, similar to Roe and taking away rights from women. But six states have already passed laws that mandate parental involvement in reviewing books. And five more states have considered that they might do the same. What's happened is post-COVID, parental involvement is being used as an excuse for parents to kind of weave their way in, but it's not really parents. It's more conservative lawmakers trying to get rid of books that talk about, you know, people being gay or people of color in our history. The Diary of Anne Frank, the Bible. I mean, the list goes on and on. It seems to be very full of things relating to, you know, people of color and books written by people of color or our country's true history there, history of the Holocaust, really just atrocious stuff where parents should not be involved. And we're also just seeing several states being in crisis because they can't hire teachers. And again, like coming out of COVID, would you want to be a teacher with all the restrictions that we're coming out with after COVID and dealing with parental involvement on what books you can tell your class to read? It's really, really troubling times there as well. So as we close out, I just want to also invite you all on September 20th, University of Pennsylvania Annenberg School will be hosting me, and you are all welcome to join us in Philadelphia to celebrate my gifting the Weekly List Project and these podcasts to Annenberg School to be archived, along with all the stories of this time. That's again September 20th. There is an online invitation. You can find it. It's on my Twitter account, my pinned tweet, the link. You can sign up to join us there. Also, if you have images from during the list, either meeting me at book tours or speeches or the We the People March that you would like to see included in the archive, please send them my way. Again, thank you for supporting the Weekly List, and we will keep you posted. Don't forget to vote in 80 days. Signing off.